we're all actually very similar in terms of what a play is trying to do is get at this essential human condition. And even though the lived experience of a white woman like me is very different than a black woman or an immigrant woman in this country or a person with different abilities, we are at some point in our life going to experience love and heartbreak and loss and betrayal. And those core human things, I think, are the things that we can look around and say, I felt that too, or I know someone who has felt that. And I think playwriting and theater allows us to accept the different human experience of somebody and honor what is different about it, but also say, and yet we are still going through something that is uniquely human.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I'm a documentary filmmaker and National Geographic explorer. And on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. This week, my guest is Lauren Gunderson. Lauren is one of the world's most prolific playwrights. At 37, she is the most produced playwright in America and has taken home many of the most coveted awards in playwriting. In 2017, The New Yorker wrote a profile on Lauren and titled it, quote, "You've probably never heard of America's most popular playwright," end quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, everybody out there listening, it's about time you heard. Lauren received her BA in English Creative Writing from Emory University before earning an MFA in Dramatic Writing at NYU Tisch. Some of her most recent plays include The Revolutionists, Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley, The Book of Will, The Taming, Silent Sky, and I and You. I am so excited to share this episode with you all, especially if you love theater or just consider yourself a story nerd like I consider myself. Lauren's knowledge and experience is off the charts, and today she is about to lead a storytelling masterclass. So if you want to get your notebook, pen, paper, take some notes, I know I was during this conversation. In this episode, Lauren and I discuss how a lack of female representation in theater fueled her to write some of her first plays as a teenager. We talk about how she structures stories with an eye on pacing and character transformation. And then finally, we get into why storytelling is at the core of what makes us human. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Lauren Gunderson. Lauren Gunderson, welcome to the Austin Meyer Podcast.
Thank you so much.
So great to be here.
Thanks.
So we are in your office.
Yes.
Right now. Is this where you do most of your writing?
This is it. This blue attic-y place with good natural lighting and a standing desk and a rug that looks like the stars. The pattern on the rug is actually from a Hubble image, so it feels like I'm kind of standing in the stars. That doesn't hurt my creativity.
One of the reasons I love doing the podcast in person, other than it helps me connect to the person better, is I love seeing people's spaces where they create their art, their stories. First thing that stands out to me in here is the walls, which you can write on.
Oh, yes.
You have some chalk on the walls. So what kind of things do you use the walls for in this room?
I mean, a lot of it is lists, just what are the things that I've agreed to write, want to write, want to pitch, kind of keeping things in order. There's three lists over there that says plays, TV, and film, and they're different progress. They're different projects in progress, and some of them are done now. I can go check them off in a very dramatic fashion. it feels very good to check something off. And then other ones is just kind of keeping, sometimes you need to just have a tangible access to story structure or character arcs, and it is a fun way to do that with this chalk that I can kind of just draw a story and figure out the distance. Sometimes it's helpful to see visually the distance between when a character is introduced and then when their big scene is and how they function in the climax of a story. And sometimes visual elements help. When I teach, I often employ kind of a more traditional form of teaching, but then also graphs and diagrams and pictures, because it, I think, especially something as both fundamental and then strangely intangible as story structure is, how you teach story, what is the science of it? Mm-hmm. Sometimes people need to get their hands on it and see it, draw it, to investigate it properly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you think about, do you think about story often in terms of, I mean, even just that notion of space,
yeah,
right? Like visualizing a story, yeah, in real, in a real tangible way. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of sketch out, like how does that happen, I guess?
Yeah.
Or what do you do?
I think that I write backwards. So I always think of the point of the story, the end of the story, the climax of the story. Where are we going? What is this about? What is the whole journey? I.e., where are we going? And I think if you think about that destination, then the journey getting there will be rich and focused. And that is really, certainly in my particular field of theater, which also includes screenwriting for film and some for TV, but certainly for TV and film, it is an efficient art form. You have to get to the point. And sometimes that it feels technical. There are details, exposition, plot points that have to happen to be able to set up the great big emotional moments or action moments that you want. But knowing where you're going is one of those, the biggest things. I can't begin to write until I know the ending, which sounds strange. Like, how on earth does that work? You got to start the thing to know where that goes, right? But for me, I can't, because I think the reverse engineering of it means that I get to know who in the story do I need to put in to earn that great moment. And one of the easiest examples is a love story, right? The question you're going to have to answer at some point if you're truly writing a love story is, are they going to get together or not?
Right.
And that could mean marriage. It could mean best friends for life, not married. It could mean they have sex. It could mean they don't. It could mean they become business partners instead of marriage, whatever. But are they going to be together or not? And then you reverse engineer from that. And so if your story is a story where, yes, they are going to get together, okay, well, a little bit before that, it's got to be really hard. They got to feel like they're never going to get together. So backing up a little bit. And then before that, it's got to be great. Oh my gosh, this is totally going to work. And then before that, they've got to meet. Okay, so that is in some ways an entire romantic comedy that I've just outlined in those four steps, starting at the end. Now, you can do it the other way, whereas let's say they don't get together, then there's got to be a moment right before that where they are definitely going to get together, right? So the surprise is that they don't. And then before that, it's got to be really complicated and maybe they shouldn't get together. And before that, how do they meet? Okay. So there's two whole stories that you can do that. Now, the other thing that I will, as a caveat, say, because it sometimes sounds so formulaic and so anti-creative when you talk about, you know, figure out the ending and just write to it. But that's not exactly what I do. I figure out the kind of ending it is. And okay. So for, say, something like Romeo and Juliet, if Shakespeare were like me, and he thought, okay, so I think they're going to get together. Cool. Which they do in this movie. In the play. Of course, when he gets to that last scene, maybe he's like, you know what? Totally better if one of them dies. Oh my God, actually better if they both die. This is great. He rewrites the prologue about, you know, two star-crossed lovers take their own lives. Fine. So you can, the whole point is you can get to an ending, even if you've decided what kind of ending it is, and still iterate and surprise yourself and be creative and find the most fabulous, strange, beautiful, tragic way to spin on it. Hmm. But again, for me, finding the ending means you can go back and design a story that earns that ending. Hmm. And I feel like if you start and just expect to magically stumble or find your way into a perfectly structured story, it's probably not going to happen. And you're going to get that thing that happens when you get to page 20 or 30 of a script and go, oh, I'm blocked. Oh, I don't know what to happen next. Oh, I'm not sure what's next. It's like, well, because no, you don't. You didn't know where you were going and you just went. Sometimes that can provide a lovely journey, but sometimes you'll get stranded on a mountain because you didn't know where you were going and you didn't plan right, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I want to come back to structure, mm-hmm, once we get a little bit more of your, sure, background.
Yeah.
And just to preface why I'm excited to talk to you about structure is, as I mentioned, I'm a documentary filmmaker trying to figure out how to be the best I can be. And kind of like when I was doing journalism in the written form, I was coming from a creative writing background, and I was always aspiring to write like journalism pieces that almost read like fiction.
Yeah.
Like they had that kind of arc, they had that kind of beauty, but then they also had the clarity and brevity of journalism. I always wanted those forms to kind of come together because I thought there was huge potential there. And at the beginning of my documentary film journey, where I consider myself now, like that's where I want to be going. I want to take elements of playwriting and fiction and narrative feature films and see how can I create documentaries that do that. Mm-hmm. And even what you're saying right there about kind of planning for the ending, as I edit, I notice myself with the capability of doing that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, I now it's just like a thought experiment for me, when I go out to try to find a story, or when I am beginning shooting with someone where you don't know what's going to happen and you can't create it, what are ways that I can take that mindset of the end? Or what? Yeah.
I think that's such a fascinating question, because in playwriting, I'm God. I get to decide everything in the entire universe of this story. And in your world, you're not. you are absorbent and vigilant, and accessing the world as it's actually happening instead of designing it like I get to, which feels very, very powerful, but also very false. I mean, that's part of what that is the strange power of fiction, and how much the creators of it control versus how the world actually exists and works. And that's part of why we love fiction, because it is different than real life. But it is interesting. I will say that one thing that occurs to me is what defines a good ending still has to be related to character, and it still has to be what these people want, and that may be the same thing as what they need. It's probably not. And that's part of the wonderful character conflict that we have even in ourselves. The wants and needs tend to be different. And so I wonder, as you meet people in the world of creating great documentary, that's part of what learning is. What do they actually want? What are they actually about? And that will probably give some sense of what possible endings are there for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because it is all going to be about that in some way.
Yeah.
At least that's what's gripping about this form of story, is in some ways it is, what does a person want and do they get it? That's the entire story form, really.
Right.
And if it were that simple, it would be boring and not as powerful as it is, but that is the essential nature of it.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, like, if I were to make a documentary, maybe I didn't set out for it to be a love story, but at some point I might notice, oh, wait, this person met somebody new and it seems like there's a love story here. Having that understanding of story where I know, ooh, I need there to be more conflicts.
Yeah.
Or I need there to be barriers to that love to really make that payoff at the end really come through. Then I, as a filmmaker, I have the choice of whether to make the drive to that person's house on this one day where there might be some conflict.
Yeah,
I might find something, a moment that feels contentious in the edit or something. So
that's exactly right.
I think there are a lot of ways to do it. But okay, before we get back to the structure, which I'm excited for, I think it'd be useful to get a little bit of your backstory.
Sure.
So does your arc as a playwright, where does this begin, and where did your love for story begin?
I think it's in my childhood bedroom in Decatur, Georgia, which is a small kind of community outside of Atlanta. Very liberal, but in, you know, Georgia. so there was a beautiful complexity to my childhood just in the space of where I lived. And I found theater I don't even remember how, but I was gripped instantly. I mean, I think part of it was the performance of it. I thought I wanted to be an actor because the full-throated feelings of being on stage in a character performing, even when it's, you know, the Three Bears or something, still felt so powerful and impactful to me and felt like living, felt like a kind of living I didn't know people got to do. And so I absorbed a lot of film that I loved. I would never call them film when I was 10 years old. I would call them movies. Those, you know, very exciting movies. And I loved watching the Oscars and kind of starting to get to connect. Oh, people made them. These people, the characters weren't the movie. They were the actors doing, you know, there's a moment when all of us kind of have the bubble pop of like, oh, somebody made this fiction. It wasn't just born in the minds and mouths of the actors as they're speaking it. And then, you know, through the theater classes and summer camps and things, I started to connect the making of it and the different roles and the fact that there were writers. And I remember I got hooked up with a theater company that's still in existence in Atlanta, Georgia, Actors Express, an incredible new play company. And I did a few of their plays. They hired me as an actor pretty young. I mean, I think the first time I was hired was like 10 years old and the second was 14. And there happened to be plays for young women in them. And I remember being in rehearsal for them, feeling very proud that I was in a real play, a real actor in a real play. And thinking, oh, this play isn't that old, which means that people still write them. They still write plays now. We aren't finished with that. Mm-hmm. we have enough. We're done. You don't have to write anymore. No, we're still writing them. And to 14-year-old Lauren, that was a big moment because I thought, oh, somebody decided who dies and who wins and why and what they want and do they get it and all the things we were just talking about that writers get to decide and have to decide to make the most compelling, powerful storytelling. So that's kind of when I thought, oh, okay. Also, it was combined with being a young woman and not seeing a lot of roles for women, certainly young women, certainly roles that weren't worth playing because usually they were somebody's little sister or lover or secretary or spurned wife, and none of that felt very interesting to me. So that was the first thing I started doing was writing roles for women. And the very first play I wrote was a play that had a role for me, basically, like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old kind of girl, a mother and a grandmother. And so that's three generations of women in one play. And I just thought, I literally have never seen that. I don't think I've ever seen it. And so I didn't know that I was writing something challenging to the kind of norms of American theater. I just knew that I was writing something that was real to me and I'd never seen and I wanted to see. And so that kind of set me on the path of what I continue to write to this day.
Hmm. At that time when you were writing that first play, you said you were 16.
Yeah.
Were there not a lot of roles for women because a lot of the playwrights were men? Or what is the reason behind that?
I think that is a long and it's a very important question. I think there's a lot of different answers, but yes, I think for a long time, like most fields, whether science or art or anything, they were dominated by men and certainly in the European world, white men. And that's what happens. People write what they know and who they know and who they're around. And we tend to self-segregate as human beings. That's just kind of what we do. And so, yes, I think that is certainly part of it. And, you know, when you are told what is great, this is a great play by a great playwright, and all of them are white men, you start to absorb that and think, well, I want to be great, so I should write like them. So I should write plays with men yelling and, and getting drunk and fighting each other. And I will say, I mean, there are some incredible exceptions, Tennessee Williams being one, who I obviously gravitated to his plays as a Southerner myself and as a writer of very interesting and iconic women. Flawed and strange and poetic and, oh, I still find his plays revelations when I read them. Shakespeare. I mean, Shakespeare, for the time that he was in and comparing him to his contemporaries, he wrote incredible women, surprising, certainly his later plays. And there's some fabulous academic scholarship that track the plays and the women in his plays, especially by a woman and a performer named Tina Packer, who wrote a beautiful book called Women of Will, who basically has a thesis that starts and looks at his early plays and the kind of the smaller roles, the more expected roles for women. You know, you're either a nun or an ingenue. Like, that's kind of it. there's no mothers in most of Shakespeare. But then as you get older, you start to go, oh, now he's writing Rosalind. That's the character that has more lines than Hamlet. She's got the most lines in Shakespeare. You get Beatrice. Oh my gosh, what a brilliant wit, and also vulnerable and a lover and brave. And then you get, I mean, all of these characters, Lady Macbeth, and the kind of beautiful tragedy of her, as evil as she is, she's actually comes from a place of very personal female tragedy, and goes on and on and on. So there's really incredible roles there, and those I had access to in school. And so this combination of kind of seeking out plays on my own and kind of with an eye towards, well, what are the women doing in this play? Looking at classic plays I was given in school, and kind of finding some precedent, you know, that it's not the strangest thing in the world to have an incredibly complicated female with agency and flaw and humor and sex. Mm-hmm. They exist. We should just write a lot more of them.
Yeah. So when you're in high school and college, you're starting to write more plays. What about theater really connected with you and made you want to write in that space rather than spend a ton of time writing a novel?
That's such a great question, and it's something I still am figuring out today, but I think I've started to understand what it is. One is it is immediate, both as an actor and a writer. As a writer, I get to write something and I can just say, hey, you guys want to read this, like, now? And suddenly this thing, whereas if you're doing a movie or a novel, boy, it takes a long time. And if you're movie making, it takes a lot of money to even get to that first read of a thing. Whereas I was surrounded by artists and I would be able to write something. I still do to this day. A couple of days ago, I did a very first read of a brand new play in my kitchen around, you know, vegetarian chili and red wine, and just get great actors to come over to my table and say, thank you, let's read this thing. So there is this immediacy to it. You can make it and do it right away. And theater is this magical thing where it just takes some performers, a story, and an audience of some sort. And that's kind of it. And it can be in a backyard. It can be at the greatest theaters in the world. I love the kind of that almost rustic element to it that can become very polished. But and, you know, the other thing is, as an actor as well, it is immediate in that there are people there. You are in the room with them as they're experiencing the art that you made. And the liveness of it, there is real breath and real pulse, and it's shared. The actors and the audience are doing it in time, in the same space and time together. And a novel isn't that. Readers are not sitting next to the writer who wrote it as they're reading it, right? That would be odd. And that's not true for movies. It's not true for TV. So there is something so pure about the performing arts that is, we're in it together. And I love that sensibility of it. And I feel there's nothing like it. And I think that's why this myth that, oh, theater's dying and that nobody goes to the opera. They do. And when they go, they realize, oh, this is unlike anything. Certainly in our world of constant scrolling on screens and everything is on demand, something that says, no, you actually need to be on time and you need to come to this place and there'll be other people you don't know sitting next to you. And the magic and the alchemy of it is that one of the oldest things, the oldest ideas of humanity is the performing arts. And there is something magical that happens when you're in a room and you all gasp at the same time. You didn't know these people. You didn't plan it. You didn't know what was going to happen. And that instantly a shared reaction happens. And it can be weeping. It can be laughing. It can be gasp. But it reminds us, oh, we are living this life in the same way. We are not that different. You know, I just, oh, man, the empathy, the kind of magical, epic thought experiment in progress that is a play that you go to and you share with other people. I find it unlike anything in the world.
Yeah, it reminds me of, so I saw your play, The Revolutionists, a few weeks ago. And I mostly, I see, if I go to the theater, I'm going to see improv theater.
Yeah.
which is a totally different feel, especially when you walk into the room. Because an improv stage is just like a blank stage with a few chairs.
There's
usually
nothing there.
Right? Yeah. You walk into like the set of the Revolutionists, and it's like there's I felt so much anticipation because just the way the stage is set. And the theater I was in, there was like seats on three sides.
Oh, cool.
You know, there's crumpled paper everywhere. There's just like like you're talking about an immediacy and a presence that even before it begins, like I'm already like, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
In a way that I don't feel in any other form.
Yeah.
So when you're mentioning you're working with real people and you have real time, like it's real time that the audience is experiencing. What are ways that you leverage that as a writer?
Mm-hmm.
How are you thinking about time?
Oh, that's such a great question.
And maybe how the audience is interacting with the people on stage.
Yeah, I think about it all the time. And one of the things I love to do is to cut because I am very sensitive as a writer to pacing and length of a show, what the audience is feeling, especially in a comedy. Something that is too long is deadly. I mean, you know that in improv, of course. You can go on too long and you know it when that audience turns. But every play of mine is in many ways about speed and pause, speed and pause, speed and pause, because that is what dictates a joke. Mm. The delivery of a joke is so much, as they say, all in the timing. And the enjoyment of a play, the kind of first act, end of first act itch when you're like, oh God, are we getting an intermission soon? Because I'd like a glass of wine, or I'd like to go to the bathroom, or I need to think about this. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's 2 hours of a first act, like, oh Lord, help you. So I learned that very early on, that one of the superpowers of a playwright is cutting, to know, I know that this monologue is lovely and beautiful and has some wonderful lines in it. It is not worth the audience rejecting it and turning away from the play and getting distracted and wanting to leave. So as Tony Kushner I've heard him say this a couple times, the one thing you can't do is be boring. You cannot be boring as a playwright. And it's amazing how often I go to plays and I am bored. And it would just take a few cuts to kind of keep the suspense, the kind of faster, funnier of it, just the chaos, the like wonderful choreographed chaos of a great play. So I'm very aware of timing, which is kind of what you mean. But I'm also aware of this magical moment that can happen. I'm using that word a lot, magical, magical, magical.
That's a great word.
It is, and it is, because it is odd. It is unreal. A play is unreal.
Mm-hmm.
Because if things were real, we wouldn't have endings. Plays wouldn't end. That is actually, I think that is one of the things I muse on in the play, The Revolutionist, is reality keeps going on, and it'll go on without you because we die and the world doesn't at this moment. we kind of, it keeps going. And so, one of the most interesting things and false things about a play is that it ends. And frankly, of a story is that it ends. And it usually ends with some meaning, and it ends with some like, oh, well, that's the right ending. We've learned something. We you know, whatever. And I'm always thinking about that one of the kind of bravest things about a story is it defies the physics. It says like, no, this is the end. This is all we're getting. The point is here. It's over. We're going to turn this universe off. We're turning the lights off on this entire universe and everyone in it of that story. And we're going to go back into the real world. You walk outside of the theater and you're met with, I'm holding two realities in my head at the same time in that liminal space, mm-hmm. after a show where you're still thinking about those totally fictional people. And they might have really, you might have really felt something. They might have made you cry. Might have made you think like, I need to go call my mom, or I need to tell that person I love them, or whatever. But then that's not the real world that you literally are in. I love that strangeness of it. It is, and I do think this is what makes me so fascinated in the kind of anthropological origin of story. I love this conversation that, frankly, is starting to happen more, thankfully, in this world of kind of neuroaesthetics. What is the brain on beauty? What are we? Are we attracted to certain things? What is our brain doing when we're watching ballet, when we're watching a play, when we're watching a movie? But also the kind of why did we do this? Why on earth do we make stuff up? And so much. It's not a very rare thing that humans do. It's all constant. We're constantly doing it. And the sense of going, in Yuval Harari's book, Sapiens, which I love, one of the biggest thesis points of his book is it actually wasn't language that made Homo sapiens the future dominant species on the planet. It's story.
Mm-hmm.
It's fiction.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh, my God.
The and ability when I read to gather groups around mm-hmm. a common belief, which is set by story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how powerful it is. It is a way of accomplishing things that other animals have to work really hard to do, like gathering people, focusing their attention, getting them to think. A lot of animals think one thing in a certain time, to do a thing together, to do a thing again and again and again without prompting. All of this is the difference between using language to say, I will give this thing a name, that is a lion. Okay, sure, fine. And then to the graduation of that is going, okay, well, let's start telling the story of the lion. Okay, so the lion seems to drink water here most days. And then that makes you think, oh, well, if he drinks the lion there, maybe if we wanted to kill it, we'd just go wait by the water and kill it there. Okay, so that's starting to be rehearsal. We're already graduating into theater. Okay, planning, rehearsal, story helps that. We can go, let's use data we know and then play it forward. Imagine what happens. But I think the most interesting thing is when we start the graduation from that is empathy, where we say, I wonder what it's like to be the lion. That's when story, I think, goes from helpful and understandable to a whole a revelation. Because now we're going, what is it like to be someone that's not me? And not have it go, well, I can't understand that because they're not me. And you can't connect. Well, what if you could connect to a person you thought you hated, to this predator, a lion, to a god, to, oh my gosh. Now we're starting to really see the superpower of storytelling. Is that it gets us in a different mindset, a whole different frame of mind. And wow, what does that unlock in terms of understanding each other, understanding our place in the world, unpacking peace, which generally works for a lot of people. Most people want that, but you need to have empathy to understand how to do it. Anyway, I could go on and on. I love this conversation. I love where science and story meet. I love...
Well, let's keep on that idea of empathy and seeing yourself in the characters you create. Because like when I go to a play like The Revolutionist, I am unlike anyone in that yes. play on the surface.
Yes.
Right? So how do you create characters that the audience sees themselves in, or if that's not the right phrase, wonders, what would I do in that situation?
I think, but that's the entire point of theater and why it exists is to have every person in the audience go, what would I do? And that's what binds us all. That is empathy because, and to clarify for your listeners, The Revolutionist is a play about four women during the French, the kind of last most violent phase of the first French Revolution, set in 1793. And one of the characters is very well-known, Marie Antoinette. One of the characters is somewhat well-known, Charlotte Corday. She killed Jean-Paul Marat in the bathtub. There's a great painting of her by David. And so you can find more information about her. One of the characters is not well-known at all. Her name is Olympe de Gouges. She was a real woman, a playwright, feminist at the time, and wrote the first Western Declaration of Women's Rights. This was several years before Mary Wollstonecraft did the same thing in England, but she's more known for it. And then the last woman is a combination of truth, myth, and fiction because she is a black woman, and we don't have a lot of history at that time for what black women were doing during these revolutions. And the play also includes the Haitian Revolution, which was happening at the same time. Of course, the island wasn't called Haiti. It was called Saint-Domingue. But it was a French colony who was rebelling for its right to not be enslaved, for its own freedom, at the same time that the French were rebelling against the king and the patriarchy and the institutions of France for the same thing. And yet it was bizarre that a black colony would say, yeah, no, we want freedom too. You guys want it? Why don't we get it? So all of these four women are at this time of crisis. And it is a play that combines all of them because of their different stations, their different motivations. But you should walk away feeling really compelled by each of them. We're assuming that we're going to write off Marie Antoinette as nothing but kind of a silly rich father. sop. But she becomes, in many ways, a surprisingly heartful and heartfelt character. And a lot of the other, you know, one of them is like an out and out murderer. Charlotte Corday is like, I'm super excited to murder this guy today. And we would generally think, I'm not going to be a fan of a murderer, but we understand what, where she's coming from. And she realizes, oh, maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. And okay. So all of these characters, I think the entire point of a play, if it is well written, the definition of well written is feeling empathy for these people. It occurs to me that the definition of melodrama includes they're so archetypical that we know they're bad from the beginning. We know they're, you know, ingenuous and, you know, whatever from the beginning. We don't go with them anywhere. We kind of know what we're getting, and the emotions are very broad and obvious. And I think part of what the job of a good play is to engage, surprise, and to transform an emotion. So if we feel this way about someone at the beginning, the play should transform that emotion into the end. Much like the character should be very different than who they are when we meet them at the beginning of a story. We should see them change. Otherwise, when I teach, I often say, if they don't change, you're writing the wrong part of the story. We want to hear the story where things change, people change, where they are forced to make what I like to say is a character-defining decision. And each one of the women in that play and in all of my plays have that moment. That's what a climax is. That's what the end, the kind of ramp to the end of a story is having all of the things that we've seen for the last hour and a half or so of a play come to a head and make the main character do something. And it's got to be an immediate action that needs to be taken or a decision. It has to be something that defines who they are. As Aristotle says, it's not what we say, it's what we do that defines us. So that's why it can't just be them giving a speech or saying an apology. It's like, no, you need to, the authenticity of it is the action of it.
Right.
And the consequence. Mm. So that is part of, I think, the basis of the question of how you relate is through the journey, you will find yourself more connected to these people than you perhaps thought when you began. And the other answer is we're all actually very similar in terms of what a play is trying to do is get at this essential human condition. And even though the lived experience of a white woman like me is very different than a black woman or an immigrant woman in this country or a person with different abilities, we are at some point in our life going to experience love and heartbreak and loss and betrayal. And those core human things, I think, are the things that we can look around and say, I felt that too, or I know someone who has felt that. And I think playwriting and theater allows us to accept the different human experience of somebody and honor what is different about it in this intersectional kind of way. But also say, and yet we are still going through something that is uniquely human, or specifically, you know, the general and the specific start to become the same at a certain point. So,
you mentioned that you start writing by thinking about the end. Mm-hmm. Does that also go for character arcs? Like, for example, if you have these four women who make up the revolutionists, or in any other your other plays, are you thinking, where do I want this character to end up? Thus, I need them to start in a very different place.
Yes.
And are you thinking about each character in that way?
It's usually thinking about the main character first, and then as the development of the story goes on, yes, that is certainly on my mind of going, how is that a character journey? That is a character arc, is where do they start, where do they end? Mm-hmm. But a good example is from The Revolutionist, the character of Marie Antoinette and Marianne Angèle, who is the black Haitian woman in the play. At the beginning, they do not like each other at all. Marianne certainly doesn't like Marie Antoinette and obviously blames her for the great tragedy of slavery's cost on the people of Saint-Domingue, which is pretty valid. but then, of course, at the end of the play, once we get to the end, they have become closer than almost any other people because they're the only moms in the play, or they're, you know, the ones who talk about motherhood and children. They talk about love. They talk about heartbreak. They both lost husbands. And so this strange, odd couple-ness becomes, which is totally opposite of where we began. So I think that is certainly critical in having having journey. And the other thing is, in terms of less in terms of kind of literary, highfalutin academic, like story requires this and this and this. It's just more entertaining. We want to see people change. We want to, because it's hard to change. And hard things, that struggle, that crisis, is what we're there for. And again, not to go bring everything back to like biological anthropology, but that is, I think, the entire point of why we gave birth to storytelling at all. It is a thought experiment. We need to see, so how do you change? Well, I'm going to watch Hamlet or King Lear or Oedipus Rex, and I'm going to go, okay, what would I do if I had this batch of kind of occurrences happen to me at this time and I were this kind of person? Or, you know, so what we're doing is going for answers. We're looking and saying, what would I do if I lost the love of my life? What would I do if somebody was this unjust to me, or my country or my family? So we are looking for examples so that if that happens to us in any version in our life to come, we'll have some practice. So theater is one of the ways that we practice our humanity, our empathy, our wisdom. I like to say that storytelling is portable, contagious wisdom. You can tell it again. You can take it with you anywhere because it's just in your mind. And it to me is one of our greatest powers, is this sense of being able to share scary things, beautiful things, inspiring things. And we take them with us until we lose our memory or our lives.
So what questions drive you as a playwright? Because I imagine as an audience member, I'm sitting there watching and thinking, could I see myself as this character? Could I see myself as this character? And then playing the God role that you do as the playwright, to even choose what to dedicate a ton of time and research and energy and money into, I imagine that every project you're going into, you also have to be satisfying some curiosity and question that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it changes, I think, as I grow in age and become mom and, you know, face the things that you do when you age, which you start losing people. I will say that what I continue to go back to thematically, even as my very first play, is about legacy. It's about love. And mortality, and this sense of what we leave behind when we die, how to approach death with power, with meaning. I mean, part of it is because I'm scared of it, and I think we're all in some version scared of dying, or dying without making a difference, or dying without meaning anything, or. So even as a kid, I was kind of confounded by this. And the only way to approach it was to approach it. And so I started writing. And a lot of the plays are about people who end up facing their own mortality, but they face it with kind of a grace and an eventually earned grace, and are a way to articulate, you know, what they mattered, how they mattered. One of my earlier plays, Emily, which is about... A physicist, before that was really a word. Emily du Châtelet is her name. She was a mathematician and physicist in the 17th century. And that's what the whole play is about, really, is her learning that the permission she always wanted from the world, she could give herself. And that she learns it, of course, on the way to death. And Silent Sky is about a female scientist who ends up approaching mortality, her own mortality. Yeah, I mean, they're all about this, because I think we're never going to escape that reality, because we are animals that know that that's coming. I find the fear and kind of tremble of that to be exhilarating, too. On my better days, I suppose it's exhilarating. Yeah. Some days it's just, you know, but I also think that we are surrounded by models of meaning. My play, The Book of Will, is about the legacy of Shakespeare, which of course we all know, Shakespeare has a legacy. It's pretty big. But right when he died, his friends didn't know that. They didn't know that his plays would last even 5 years after he died, much less generations and generations. And So the play is about right after he dies and his friends take up this wild effort to publish his plays. Of course, we know that this happens to great success as we are still doing them a lot, even now and in countries that weren't even named, certainly by Western names at that point. So anyway, I constantly go back to this sense because I feel like I want to prepare myself to be strong when someone I love dies or when I die.
It's beautiful. I wanted to share a quote with the listeners that I'm not sure if it's attributed to you or somebody else, but I heard you say it when I was watching one of the lectures that you've given at the Marin College.
Yeah. Oh, at the Marin Theater Company.
Yeah, Marin Theater Company. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "We make art because we need to find a sense of coherence in a chaotic world."
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I love that. And I think it gets at what we're talking about.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think that's the entire reason that story exists, is because we would love for real life to have more structure and more rules and more of a sense of, but what's the point? What did all of this mean? And a story has rules, structure, and you should walk away at the end of a play going, oh, I get it. I learned something. I was challenged and confronted by something, and I'm starting to unpack it. Or I see now, or it confirms something that you've always thought. There's a point. There's a moral. And it might be subtle, or it might be pretty frothy, of like, love is fun. Sure, fine. Or it may be that the entire point of life is, you know, loving people that you thought were unlovable. I don't know, just making that up. Sounds like a good play, though, right? So, yes, I think coherence is what we're looking for.
Yeah, I love that quote. All right, so I wanted to get back to structure, mm-hmm. Which we touched on a little bit at the beginning of our conversation. And let's think about plays in a two-act structure.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to see a play, or if you're writing a play, mm-hmm. and it's just a kick-ass first half.
Yeah.
What happens in a first half of a play? Like, what do you want to accomplish as a writer in the first
half
of a play?
Super great. Oh, what a fun thing. I think I like to start plays in the middle of the action. So I don't need 5 or 10 minutes of kind of somebody coming in and cleaning the living room, if that is the set, and opening the windows. You know, I'm like, no. I want it right when somebody bursts in and is like, how the hell could you da-da-da-da? Or it's just a sword fight. You know, we're inventing a play. So literally, what if you started in the middle of an action and they're just, you just open, lights up, and there's 2 or 3 or 10 people just in a brawl. Okay, what is this play, right? You start with a lot of questions, but with a lean forward kind of question. There's a lot to unpack and answer. I like to get the exposition done as quick as we can. And that is, it sounds like a chore, but it kind of is. So we need in the first 20 minutes, ideally first 10, to get the necessary exposition. Who are these people? How are they related? Unless there are some surprises that you're going to save for a little bit later, which you always got to have a couple. So I love to start a play kind of with a bang, get through that exposition in a way that is fast, not like a brick of data that lands on the audience that is very obvious.
So exposition, would that be like, just making sure the audience knows, like, this character is from this place and they're related in this way.
Yep.
It's kind of just like...
Yeah. Are they brother and sister? Are they husband and wife?
Okay.
Did they just, you know, did somebody just die? Did somebody just have a birthday? Like, just the world we're in? And frankly, is this set in 1600? Is it set now? Does it matter when it's set? And there are subtle ways, and they should be subtle, because otherwise exposition just feels like you're getting knocked over the head with it, and the audience turns against you and the writer, because people don't walk in and say, "Hello, I'm Lauren Gunderson. I was born in 1982 in Decatur." What? Sorry. Yeah. That feels like, this is odd.
But exposition is not this where you're revealing like what a character's desire is.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I mean, it can be, but I think more exposition is, what are the facts? The rules of the world, what world are we in?
Okay.
And who's there?
Okay.
It's not actually exposing anything, as the word might sound like it is. It's just, what are the kind of, what's the ground
context,
plan?
Yeah,
blueprinting. And then we need to know, furthermore, what do they want? And again, subtlety is going to help you here, because if somebody comes out and says, I want, you know, this person to tell me they love them because I was never told I was loved as a child, you're like, oh my Lord, what, is this, are you in therapy? If you're not in therapy, that is a weird thing to say out loud. But figuring out what is their desire, what's the thing, and what's getting in their way. It's got to be a hard goal. So when we're looking at that first act thing, you should walk away, frankly, knowing who the main character is. And this is a battle I often get in of, well, but my play is actually about a family. So it's about five people. And you're like, no, it's not. It's about one person, which one person, they can be very close, the family. And Romeo and Juliet is very close. Romeo and Juliet's goals are very close, but it's about Romeo. So figuring out who is that doesn't mean that the other characters can't have amazing roles and kind of iconic characters built around them, that you don't have to be, you know, the most incredible character and be the main character. But we need to know kind of who we're following. Whose action are we following? Who do we care about? What do they want? What do we expect that they're going to get in that first act? Now, each, in terms of very kind of literal structure, I like to think of each scene or beat, if it's one kind of act and a more nebulous scenic structure, we're getting to a peak of energy, a peak of argument, something that's kind of driving the scene, where it's not just a normal day that everyone's just kind of sharing information randomly. No, there's an urgency. Somebody needs something. I need to talk to you about this. No, not that. This. I need to talk to you about this. Well, why aren't you listening? You never listen to me. Boom. And at the boom, at the peak, is when something is revealed. And that is anything from I am pregnant, or I love you, or I hate you, or I've always hated you, or I don't know, I just won the Nobel Prize. I don't know, something can kind of peak at that moment, because frankly, we are, as an audience, listening intently, because arguments fascinate us. Human beings are always very attentive to other human beings in crisis. So use a moment of crisis strategically to put a piece of information that we need. And that starts to set in motion a change. So each scene has to have a peak, a reveal, and a change. And once something changes, we can move on to the next scene. And ideally, that change will be like a domino that tips over the next scene's domino. So they have to be related. It's hard to go from a scene about this to a scene about something totally different. So keeping that character journey going forward. And so I think... another thing to think about is if your play has access to a lot of humor, if it's really dramatic, if it has music, if it's poetic, all of these things will define the very specific voice of a play. And I like plays that go fast, that have a lot of humor in them, but can still be about things, intelligent characters. I like plays that have other kind of levels going on, whether it's science or history or something like that to play with as well. But anyway, so now we have this one scene that tips over the other scene, but the whole act itself should have the same structure as that scene I was talking about, with a rise and a peak.
Okay.
So the whole act should have that same macro scale that was a micro scale earlier, meaning before the intermission, there's got to be this bum. And a big, at the top of the peak of the whole act is a bigger revelation, a bigger challenge, a bigger moment of decision, a bigger surprise that is obviously going to have a revelation, have a change of heart come to it. But because it's at the intermission, you actually don't have to see them change yet. That's that feeling of like, what's going to happen, that you want in a good intermission. So the ba-ba-da-ba-ba-da-boom, you can end on someone enters and says, you can't marry him, he's my husband, or surprise, I'm not dead, or I don't know, something.
Yeah.
Depending on how far school you want to go. Or the revolution is starting now, or I don't know, anything. Oh, the baby's coming. Whatever. You can end with that gasp, that sense of, oh, we are in the middle of this feeling. It's not done yet. If it's too resolved, I think people go, oh, is that not the end of the play? Oh, I thought we were done. Mm-hmm. Instead of feeling like, great, we're just getting started. So you want to come back into that second act with a lot of power. Now, the truth is that even in a play that does not have an official intermission, where you go and get some wine and come back in, you can still have this structure. You still need halfway through to have this big game change.
Okay.
So I would say right in that middle, this is true for a lot of screenwriting, mm-hmm. technique as well. Mm-hmm. You need that midpoint where something goes, it becomes more serious, more outrageous, more dangerous. Something is, the stakes go way up.
Okay.
Otherwise, I will say physically, people get bored. Mm-hmm. They just get ready for it to be over. And so if that, whoa, that changes, it's like the acceleration you feel going around a corner. You need the kind of, oh, we're doing something different now.
Yeah.
And that is both, it literally is a physical thing that you can see in the audience that kind of starts to dip. So so that intermission has to be big. And then again, if the act is, has that macro structure that the scene had, the whole play has that same structure. So about 15 minutes before the end of a play, if it's an hour and a half play or a scene, or a scene before the denouement, we need to hit that climax. And the climax is, again, that same ramp up. And sometimes it is a physical ramping up. It's a battle, like in Hamlet, it's the sword fight. It can be an emotional battle. The, you know, we're finally going to say the truth.
Right. That was the revolutionists.
That happens in the revolutionists. Yeah. It's, yeah, the things that we've been polite about, we're not going to be polite about anymore. And there's got to be a reason. It can't just be like, all right, I'm ready to fight. It needs to be this, you have this internal engine, urgency, this ticking clock, as they say. Why now? Why are we having this battle now? And if there's no reason, you got to make a reason because the audience will sniff out the falsity of that. But if you've got a great reason, this climax happens. And the climax, the peak of the climax is, as I said, this moment of decision. This character-defining moment where we see who Hamlet is. So the peak of that, of the play Hamlet, Hamlet is fighting Laertes in front of, and this is key, the entire upper echelon of Denmark society, because this is the prince and the other princey-like person, very famous young dudes that everyone cares about, and they're fighting each other. Cool. So everyone who's anyone is there watching, which means that when Laertes says out loud, "The king's to blame," Hamlet is proven correct. The entire journey of that play is actually met in that moment, in that line. And it's not because Hamlet finally kills the king. It's because the king is outed as the killer that he is, which Hamlet has been wondering about. He saw this ghost that told him the king killed him, but he's a ghost. Are ghosts real? Am I crazy? Okay, I might actually be crazy. So, but then other things start to prove that that might be true. But what am I do if I do think he's guilty? Do I kill him? Do I wait? Oh, no, he's praying. I can't kill him now because I'll go straight to heaven. I don't want that. Okay, the whole freaking 5 hours of this play is met in the moment when Laertes says to a crowded room, "The king's to blame," and everyone goes, oh, and Hamlet is like, aha. Because it is after that moment, and this is the character-defining journey. So at the peak of the climactic moment, a moment of revelation, Laertes says, "The king's to blame." This is a revelation for everybody, except for, you know, the king who knew he was a killer, for Hamlet who thought he was a killer, and for everyone else in the room was like, oh, I did not know that. Interesting. But right after that moment of revelation, structurally, we have a decision. It's a change. And Hamlet cannot go back from this change because he kills the king, which the character-defining moment of that, part of it is like, aha, he finally did it. And also, you know what he just became? The same thing as his uncle. He became a king killer. So in the journey, what he has proven, Hamlet proves himself to be the exact same thing as the thing he hates, which means there is something rotten in the state of Denmark, which we learned in the very first act of that play. Shakespeare is very, very smart. So it all comes to a head. The whole thesis of the play that there is something rotten in the state of Denmark is proved correct. Hamlet's thesis, his uncle killed his father, is proved correct. And Hamlet's thesis about himself is proved correct, that I am a man of action, turns out, and the action proves me to be just as rotten as everyone else in this damn country. So that's a pretty satisfying climactic moment. The other sneaky tricks are, there are lots of things that have been planted earlier in the play that come to a head there. Hamlet's mother has a famous death in that moment. Laertes' relationship with his sister Ophelia, and Hamlet's relationship with Laertes' sister Ophelia, is brought up because they just found her dead. So there's all sorts of things on symbolism, language that is being reused at this moment, or borrowed from earlier parts of the play, which makes it feel this kind of strange nostalgia. It feels electric, like I've heard this before. Oh my gosh, this is where we've been leading this whole time. Mm-hmm. It's also a very exciting setting. It's a public sword fight. Mm. Sure, that's more interesting than like a, you know, a garden, you know, or something, yeah, you know, private and boring. Like, no, they got swords out and people tallying strikes and hits, a very palpable hit, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of extra to this scene, which smartly he does to raise the stakes even more. And then after that, structurally, after we have our ramp up, our moment of reveal, and our moment of decision, character defining decision for our main character, we have the denouement. And that is where things start to kind of settle back into a new reality. It's not the same reality we had at the beginning of the play, because that would be, we haven't gone anywhere. So we have a new reality now. But this is where we get the people, in the case of Hamlet, people dying. The case of Romeo and Juliet, also people dying.
So in the, just denouement, is that my saying?
Denouement,
that right?
Yeah.
Is that where, as you were saying earlier, it's about what you do and not what you say. So you have this character who started in one place, they've changed, they've ended in this new place, mm-hmm. but it's not enough to just have them be like, oh, I get it. They have to prove that revelation with some sort of action.
Yeah, and that's more climax. That is the moment of climax is the moment of action. Hamlet literally with his hand takes a poisoned glass and shoves it in his uncle's mouth and says, follow my mother, who just died of the same poison. So he literally with his hands does something to not just say, I hate you, king. All right. Or like, I wish you dead. No, he's like, no, I'm going to actually make you dead.
Okay.
So that's where we see this character defining action. Mm-hmm. The denouement is basically what happens next. How do we leave this world? What is the consequence of all of this? And the consequence for Hamlet is he's been stabbed by a poison sword. This is a big spoiler for Hamlet. so he is now in his final moments alive, figuring out what all this meant, as is the audience, truly, which is, again, is very smart of Shakespeare to kind of give the audience words for their feelings, too. And this is where he says to Horatio, his best friend through the whole thing, that, you know, tell my story, basically, is the end of the story, which is kind of meta and gorgeous and beautiful. And a beautiful line that Horatio says, good night, sweet prince, may flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
You've read Hamlet a couple
times. I have read it a few times. I have. I might love it a little bit. And also hate it at times too, which is great to kind of be in this complex relationship with something as important as that play. But
so when I saw The Revolutionist, I came out of that and really wanted to ask you this question.
Yeah, cool, exciting.
Because I'm reading currently a book that Kat Zidane, former guest of the podcast, recommended to me. It's called Anatomy of Story by John Truby.
Yes, she I said love it
was,
that book.
She said it was her favorite, on storytelling.
Oh, it's great.
So I'm learning a lot of new concepts, learning a lot of new strategies, and learning also about how to create a main character mm-hmm. or your hero. Yeah. And then you have an opponent, and then you have what the author calls this character web. And it's how all these different characters who come up interact with your hero or your main character and force them to confront their wants and needs in unique ways. So I came to your play and I'm like, all right, I'm in this book. I'm reading this book. I'm ready to try to chart out how this play fits into what I'm learning.
Yeah.
And I was even trying to do this stuff with my mom at intermission. I'm like, okay, so what's happening here? And I found it was hard.
Yeah.
It was really hard with your play. Yeah. At times I was like, I thought I knew who the main character was. Mm-hmm. But what I really wanted to ask you about is this character web, because there's such a, all the characters in that play, there are four of them, are so beautifully fleshed out and they have such unique roles in which they interact with the main character. Mm-hmm. So maybe not too specifically on The Revolutionist, just because who knows who's seen it. Yeah. But just in general, how do you think about a character web and how it interacts with the person that everyone cares the most about, which is this main character?
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think about what each character pulls out of the other. Because it's not enough to have an interesting person in your play. It's an interesting person that is a catalyst for the main character's journey. And by that I mean, it's not the person that just sits there and asks, how you feeling today, Bob? But it's the person that challenges them, that perhaps agrees with them, but then switches and starts to not agree with them. And that is challenging for the character. The character that pushes the person, it's not always just an antagonist saying, you know, have at thee, and draws a sword and tries to kill the main character. It's somebody who is a friend, but a friend that can tell them the truth and go, why are you doing this? You sound crazy right now. What's gotten into you? Or the person that's like, yes, I'm totally behind you. Whatever you need, let's go do it now. Woohoo! So I think of that idea of a character web is it's almost like the characters are winds, and the main character is a boat with a sail, you know, and that another character can change the course of this person or make it really hard to stay on course. It's weather around the main character in some way. So thinking about, and that's just the one character's journey. Now, each character themselves will be buffeted by other characters' weather, right, to continue the metaphor. But I think that's part of how it functions in story is sometimes I think, oh, you know what? I need a main character, or I need to add a character to a story that can push this main character to make this decision. And if you think about it like that, then that makes it harder for a character to get to what they want. So if you need it to be harder, put more people in the way. Put someone they really love, the love of their life, saying, don't do that. Oh, well, that's suddenly a much more interesting play than just having one person go, I would like that, and everyone go, okay. Right, so trying to make it, and what matters most to us is people. Human beings are the most highly social species on the planet. We're really good at language. And those two things combined means that we care, are constantly looking at other people. We want to investigate other people because it's for our own survival. We can't live alone. Human, in our highly social nature, we die without other humans. So that makes us very aware at all times of other people. It also makes us just interested and fascinated by them. So part of why that is and why it's hard, why something like one-person shows are hard, is because we exist in a world of other people. One-person shows can also be fabulous, but it's a harder art form to perfect. But so that is to say, other characters in the play, you know, aren't just, you know, megaphones. They are forces of nature against this main character. And can be specifically designed to bring out, all right, what's the love, what's the betrayer, what's the hatred, what's the fear. And you can, I mean, that's a good thought experiment, is to just literally write out major human emotions and then write characters that inspire those emotions in the main character. And yeah, that could be an interesting play.
Yeah, it was really interesting for me to read about that, just because I was very aware of like the thought and care that goes into like the main character and the opponent, but not as much in how this larger character web, how those are interacting with each other. Yeah. And then seeing your play was like, wow, okay, now I see how that's being done at a really high level. I saw like the main character didn't have like a lot of conviction.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And so who's a great other character to come in? Someone who has complete conviction.
All conviction, yes,
right?
Yes.
And then, and so, yeah, so it was just great.
I worked a lot on the balance of that show because, because you need to have the complementarity to have conflict. And complementarity, I don't necessarily mean that they get along. I mean that they, where one character has a vacuum of a certain kind of thing, the other character is full. So we balance, and that changes the kind of internal chemistry.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, we're almost out of time here for the main show.
Oh heavens.
I
think your readers would like to know that my cat is sitting right next to me and has been the whole time. She
so
is
adorable.
The actual writer.
A lot of the
she
inspiration
would never right admit now. It. Good job, Mitten.
Okay. You are an extremely accomplished playwright, and have produced tons of plays. An amazing title of being one of the most produced playwright other than Shakespeare.
I know. That's pretty nice, right?
Crazy. Yeah. Congratulations.
He wins all the time, though.
So, like, where are you trying to get better? Like, what are the challenges for you right now? Where do you see as, like, the next level in your it's playwriting or or screenwriting journey.
Yeah. Where? I think about that all the time. Because I will say, and I hope this doesn't sound entirely arrogant, but I feel like I've had a career that's proven that I can write a play. I can write a play that I would like to go see. I would like a play that fills a void that I haven't seen plays written. And so I'm quite proud of the plays that I have written. But I am constantly thinking about, okay, what if I were tasked with not writing a play like any of my plays before, which it should be every play one writes, or whatever art form is yours, the next piece should be a challenge to everything else you've done before. Artists are generally never satisfied and never done with exploring the craft. But, you know, sometimes I got into a mode of going, oh, I know how to write this story. And I kind of even forget that I haven't actually written the play yet because I already have it in my mind. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'll write that one day. So, but that to me tells me, as kind of fun as that sounds, it also tells me that there may be too much in me that has already decided the course of a form of story instead of exploring it and pushing it. So that's, to answer your question, that's where I'm going. There's a new play that I just wrote a very first draft of that I was so confused by and scared by that I had to send it to a couple of friends, including Kat Zidane, my dear friend Kat, and it's an early form, and just said, I don't know. I think this works, but I really don't know. And it took like six or seven of my fellow friends who are theater or theater adjacent people to kind of say, no, it is strange, but it does work. And I'm like, okay, I thought it might, but I don't know. So that one's a big question mark for me.
Cool.
And it's
good
a new
for you for taking that risk.
Yeah. Awesome. It's a new form for me. And I'm quite inspired by playwrights like Jackie Sibley Drury, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for her play Fairview, which is an example of an incredible, the intelligence and bravery, and her play is so exciting because it is, I've heard it described, it starts as a kind of sitcom and then turns into a real confrontation. In the case of that play, of white privilege and white gaze and all sorts of things like that. But so playwrights like that, playwrights like Sarah Rule and Paula Vogel, who continue to challenge me structurally, and with their case of Paula Vogel and Sarah Rule, just their incredible humor, but also just bizarreness sometimes. The choices are so leaps of poetry. So I look at other people. Anytime I go see writers like Lynn Nottage inspire me a lot. Her plays tend to be more grounded than something like Sarah Rule's, who can be more, not ethereal, because her plays are full of heart and muscle too. But anyway, so I do feel like I am surrounded by incredible inspiration all the time. And I am definitely one who will go see a play and ask, what would my play in that vein be like? And not necessarily write it, but just to break my brain open a little bit. And I do think the answer to a lot of what I want to do next is unpacking structure and saying, okay, what if it wasn't structured like this? And that is this new play of mine that's called Beatrice. It's basically an entire woman's life in 90 minutes, which sounds like that shouldn't work, and does challenge the form of structure that we've been talking about for the last hour that I'm so confident in. Because it's very circular, has what I would challenge would be a kind of more feminine spirit, and not even in terms of content or character, but in terms of structure. It's cyclical. It's the kind of rise into title, which is a little scary to me because I'm used to writing something in a more linear structure. But you know, that's also the thrill of being an artist. We kind of recreate the world every time we do something new. So. Yeah. And I'm excited. I don't think I'm done with asking myself that question either. I'm curious about what's next. And I'm working on some musicals, which feels very different.
Oh, wow.
You know, just in terms of the collaborative nature of them and what music does, and that it's new to me. Mm-hmm. It's not new to the world, but to me it is, or continues to feel quite new, which I love working on musicals.
What impact do you want people who go to your plays, when they walk out of the theater, what are you hoping that they think, feel? Like, what's your goal in the way that you impact people with your art?
It changes a little bit play to play, but in general, I feel like the sensation of walking out of a play of mine is something of hard hope that everything isn't perfect and the play isn't saying everything's going to be perfect. But there is hope to keep going, hope to talk to people you haven't talked to before or think you may not have anything in common with, or that new discoveries are around the corner if it's, so say, a play about science or technology. A hope to, you know, if I do just say how much this person means to me, maybe we can start talking again, or all of those things, both large and small. So I've kind of settled on that as the feeling. Some plays you feel like end as a birthday party and everyone's just delighted, and some plays are darker and harder. But I hope you walk away wanting to see more plays, feeling like there's still stuff in the world worth fighting for and worth living for and worth loving for. And perhaps with that, I'm going to bring that word back, that residual magic, feeling like there was something special that you were a part of that happened just this evening. And aren't you excited and glad that you got to be in the room with these fellow witnesses and these artists doing incredible heart and mind changing work?
Well, I felt that way.
Awesome.
Yes.
Yes. Check.
So if people want to check out your work, follow you, where should we send them on the internet?
Ooh, the internet's a big place. I do have a website, laurengunderson.com, which is somewhat attended to. I would say probably Instagram and Twitter have the most retweeted and posted stuff of what's going on immediately.
So that will share where some of your plays are being produced around the country.
And I'm lucky to have a lot of productions coming up in the next couple of years. So just keep your ears out about your local regional theater companies. Reach out to me if you're looking for some show to see. And I can, if it's not mine, I will certainly point you to other incredible work around you, because there's a lot of great theater in this country right now.
Yeah. And for folks listening, Lauren has been generous enough with her time. She's going to stick around for some post-show questions. I just want to tease that a little bit.
Ooh.
In the post-show today, we'll be asking some fun questions, like if Lauren was stranded on a desert island, but there was a theater production that only produced, was doing one play over and over again on that island. And I might say, can't be Hamlet.
Ooh, that's a good qualifier.
What would she choose? And then we'll also talk about, I have a few more questions that we didn't get to on the main show about feedback. Coming to those questions from a personal place, because I just got rocked in a feedback session for one of my documentaries. So I'm excited to ask for a little bit about
let's
that.
Talk about criticism. Yeah. It is critical.
So if you want access to the post show, that is available to Patreon members. For as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all the post shows with our guests and additional episodes. So go on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And to finish up the main show, Lauren, what advice do you have for people who want to become better storytellers? What advice would you give them to achieve that?
I would say go take part and absorb as much story as you can. For those in my field of theater, go see as many plays as you can, read a lot of plays, talk to people making them. I would say to develop a critical eye. So if you see something you like, it's not enough to say, I really like that. Ask yourself why. What exact moments stuck with you and continue to resonate with you? That will fill your well of inspiration and technique so that you can apply it when you're writing something your own to go, I want to write a scene that feels like that from that movie or film or play or whatever you saw. So getting that vocabulary. I take a lot of inspiration from books about storytelling, including the origins of story and this kind of ancient science of why the hell we do it at all, much less books on technique like Anatomy of Story.
Do you have any that you would recommend?
Yeah, there's one called Backwards and Forwards by David Ball. It's ostensibly a book about directing and dramaturgy, but it works really well for those structure nerds for theater specifically. And it's a very short book that has these tiny little chapters where you can read them in about 4 minutes, and then you have to think about them for like 4 hours.
Oh, nice.
So it's really, really good. But yes, I have a ton of I'm kind of looking at my library and I know being like, which other storybook should we do?
I can put some in the show notes if you think
of
it later.
Yeah. Yes, I'll do a reading list. And the other thing is, you know, I think we want to write stories that are about big things. Because storytelling isn't supposed to be minor. It is critical for our civilization's survival at all. So think about that in terms of storytelling. It's not just entertainment. It's not a hobby. It's not something that is extra to humanity. It is at the core of humanity. And so feeling this ancient power and purpose of storytelling, I think, can help us pick those stories that really are about something enormous, even if they are ostensibly about one person, one tiny family in a nowhere town and whatever. It can still be about the biggest things that you can dream up. What are you most scared of? What would you kill for? What would you die for? What do you want to change about the entire universe? Why not write a story about that as opposed to, let's just write about two people breaking up on a couch in New York or something. So thinking big, really engaging all of the emotions that you have, because it is, again, we're writing experiments for living and telling each other how to live and how to be and how to be together. So
amazing.
Yeah, think big, write a lot, go see plays.
Magical answer.
Magical.
Lauren, thank you so much for joining the Austin Fire Podcast.
What a great conversation.
That's it for episode 23 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much to Lauren Gunderson for sharing her wisdom. When I started this podcast, these are the types of conversations I dreamed of having. I am so grateful to have this opportunity to learn from the best, like Lauren. And I'm excited to apply these strategies to my own documentary film work. And that is the beauty of storytelling and what we talk about on this show. Sure, there are nuances and differences with every genre, whether that's film, theater, books, radio, but so much of what Lauren said today about storytelling is universal. It's applicable to whatever medium you work in or are interested in. And if you want to hear more from Lauren, we have a great post-show recorded for you in which we get into her feedback process, as well as dive into some fun questions like her desert island production, her favorite TV and podcast series, and what music she listens to when she writes. If you want to listen to the post show, it is available on the Austin Meyer private podcast feed, which is available exclusively for Patreon members. For as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all our post shows and bonus episodes, which play in your native podcasting app, and every dollar goes to help support the show. And that you can get access to over on patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. Thanks to Opus Orange for today's theme music and to you for listening. If you've been enjoying the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts, share the episode with a friend or on social media, and then hit me up on Instagram @AustinMeyerFilms to let me know what is resonating with you. What are you enjoying? It is so fun to hear from listeners. That's all I got today. So I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Until then, go out and tell some stories.